everybody. Welcome back to Orphaned Entertainment. This is Christopher.
And this is Lydia.
Lydia, welcome back.
I always get surprised. I actually have to speak or introduce myself. Oh, right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Pretty. It works a little bit better. As co-hosts, it's usually better if we talk to each other.
You mean this isn't the Thanksgiving Day parade? Okay. Got it. Yeah. And so welcome to this episode of Orphaned Entertainment.
And we have picked a fun movie for you to talk about. Well, I shouldn't say. All our movies have been fun so far.
So far, yeah. Actually, yeah, we've gotten some good ones so far. I'm looking forward to the really bad ones. I kind of love bad films, but this one doesn't quite fall in that.
Yeah, we started out with a film that we thought was going to be kind of like, oh boy. And we actually really enjoyed it. I mean, it was fun. It was a fun movie.
Definitely entertaining.
But this one, today we are going to talk about a film from 1937 called Nothing Sacred. This film stars Carol Lombard and Frederick March. It was directed by William Wellman and produced by, here's a name you'll definitely, or I would hope, anybody that likes any kind of movies will not recognize the name David O. Selznick. He's a name attached to just a couple films you might have heard of, like Gone with the Wind. So, quite a big name there with the Paramount Pictures, I believe, is the one to put this out.
Well, it's funny. I feel like everybody knows who David O. Selznick is, and so it didn't even occur to me to look up and see what he did. But,
yes.
You know, one of those huge names from the past.
Yeah, he's one of the names that... Selznick is one of the names that kind of goes along with when people talk about how Hollywood was built. Selznick comes up. I mean, it's one of those names.
Mm-hmm.
So, very important name. Yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay. And there's the awkward pause. No.
But this is a film, again, Carol Lombard, who... how do I want to start this? Let's see.
Well, okay, so let's go this route. Carol Lombard, who was in My Man Godfrey.
Yes.
Who... It seems like she wasn't originally starting off to be a comedic actress, like Ginger Rogers. Turns out that her best films are her being a comedic actress, and this is a really good example of that, where, you know, she plays those characters that gets herself into scrapes that, you know, you're not really sure how she's going to get out of them until she actually does.
Exactly. No, she was a lot of fun to watch in this film. Well, let me give you a kind of a brief synopsis of the film here. We are not going to go through it plot by plot, you know, throughout the entire plot this time around. I'm going to try something a little bit different. So, for better or worse, here we go.
Bear with us.
Bear with us, yes. All right, Nothing Sacred. The plot here is, let's see, a newspaper, I believe it was the Morning Star.
Star. Mm-hmm.
A New York newspaper. The film starts out with them launching some sort of, art, I lost the word for it.
It's a huge charity thing I don't have the word.
Yeah, they're looking for donations for an art center. It was going to be for theater and film and all this, and they were going to sponsor it, and they had what they thought was a benefactor from overseas, from the Middle East, who was going to match every dollar with $10, and... It turns out he was a fraud, and that puts the paper in a really bad spot. The one reporter that was supposedly behind all this gets demoted. And in an effort to kind of regain his stature as the star reporter of the Morning Star, he begs his boss, editor Oliver Stone. I like the name.
Yeah. That struck me too, yeah.
To give him this story that the newspaper's working on that he feels doesn't have enough human interest. It's a story about a woman in the town of Warsaw, Vermont, who was apparently dying from radium poisoning. And he's like, where's all the heart? Where's the feeling? Here's this girl facing her death, and there should be more. And
Oliver, I don't like to say this, but the paper is going to rack and ruin with me hidden away in that water cooler. Look at this.
What's that?
Poor little working girl, doomed to death from radium poisoning.
We've covered it.
Covered it? You're getting old, Oliver. Look, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines on Hazel Flagg. A poor little kid with a few months to live at the outside. doomed. Death staring her in the face. What does she feel? What does she think? Radium eating away her bones.
Don't shout at me.
Listen, Oliver, there's a story in this kid that ought to tear your heart out. Where is it? Why hasn't the star got it? I'll tell you. Because I'm stuck away in a water cooler on account of some whim of yours. Listen, Oliver, give me a chance, will you? So help me, may I drop dead, I'll redeem myself.
I ought to be shot for what I'm thinking.
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that maybe you ain't the most tittering imbecile on earth. I'm thinking that maybe you've learned your lesson.
Oliver, so help me. I'll be in
Vermont by morning.
I'll dig you up a story that'll make this town swoon. Here's my hand on it.
He's allowed to go and follow up on this story, but as it turns out, Miss Hazel Flagg, who was Carol Lombard, isn't dying of radium poisoning, but at the prospect of going to New York on the Morning Star's tab, she kind of neglects to tell this little information, and from there, hilarity ensues. And along the way, of course, our two leads do find themselves falling in love with each other, despite her not necessarily lying, but omission of truth throughout the film.
What does he call at some point? Oh, he's faking. He says, this is no time to stop faking.
Right. You know what? It kind of reminded me of this film. Reminded me of, like, pretty much if you'd watch any sitcoms through the 70s or 80s, that was this film. You know, remember that one episode where there was that misunderstanding?
And she just doesn't clarify it.
Yeah, exactly. But we should talk. Let's see. What did you think? Let me think. Yeah, see, this is going to be tough with the new format. I didn't.
I feel like I should have a. I feel like I should have 15 quotes written down.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. Go ahead.
So this is one of those films. It's got that classic Hollywood comedy style to it, where, I mean, you've got the slapstick. There's a lot of slapstick in this film. And, you know, and a lot of it's kind of underplayed, but it's slapstick before slapstick got over the top. So it's classic, good old-fashioned, you know, physical comedy that actually, it turns out, so much of this is funny, and a lot of it, it's hard to explain because it's not as if everything is just spoken throughout the whole film. So like in the beginning, when the reporter gets demoted, it shows, you know, the editor saying, you know, I'm gonna bury him, and then the next thing you see is he's writing the obituary section.
Yes.
You know, so there's this whole long, I mean, 2 or 3 minutes of him just getting knocked around down and, you know, at his desk in the obituary section, that it's hard to explain. It's not verbal humor. It's very much physical humor.
I enjoyed that scene because it looks like it's down in the basement of the building. It's nothing
the
but
archives,
card catalogs everywhere, and there's just a desk kind of just jammed in the middle of the hallway. Everyone's moving around him. He's right behind the water bottle.
The cooler.
The water cooler. Thank you.
Drops their cup on him.
Yeah,
I forgot about
water.
That.
Papers are falling. He actually has to, at one point, a woman comes by to go into one of the file drawers, and he has to sit back so she can bend over to get the drawer.
And sticks her backside in his face. So it's interesting. I mean, even that, like, so much of the comedy, we think that comedy has changed so much, you know, from, what, 1937, was it?
Mm-hmm.
To now. But, I mean, a lot of the comedy, it's still the same kind of thing, but just, you know, it seems like it's more overplayed now, kind of excessive. This is before they did all of the the sound effects and the kind of silly noise makers and all of that when they were doing the comedy. It's just kind of like you just see the situation and think it's funny.
Yeah, it's that nice
that
balance.
Sense?
Yeah, no, it did. And it's that nice balance of where it's physical comedy that you can almost believe in. It's not the ridiculous. It's not the Three Stooges. It's not even the it's not even the Abbott and Costello or Laurel and Hardy.
There's no Final Destination. Oh, is it Final Destination? Yeah, where they've got like 20 different things that have to line up perfectly for somebody to get, you know, for the end result. This is just really straightforward delivery. So you don't have to have these ridiculous things where there's a pie in somebody's hand in order to get the joke across. You know, it's just classic situational. Situational comedy, that's what I was looking for.
Yes. There's a great scene early on when Wally Cook, the reporter, played by Frederick March, if I have not mentioned his name yet, he goes to the town of Warsaw, Vermont, which I believe is a fictional town created for this film.
fictional town that sounds like a real one.
Yes. To try to track down Hazel Flagg, and no one in town was talking to him. I don't think anyone in the town gives him more than one word answers for the first 5-10 minutes that he's in town that you see.
Yeah, it's the same word per person. One of them will say yep, and one of them says nope.
Nope.
Did you catch that is the Wicked Witch of the West in there?
Yes, Margaret Hamilton shows up. She's the drugstore lady. Yeah.
Which, it was funny, because when I saw her, just looking back through IMDb, and I saw the drugstore lady, I was like, who is that? But talking about it now, I remember watching it going, oh my gosh, it's the Wicked Witch. So, which, you know, of course, this was years and years before she was in The Wizard of Oz.
So they're
all just giving him one-word answers.
Before the iconic role in The Wizard of Oz, she was a character actor through the 30s and probably even a little bit before that.
Morning, sister. You in charge here?
Yep.
I've been wandering through your fascinating metropolis for an hour. Mind if I sit down here?
Yep.
I guess you misunderstood me.
No.
You know Hazel Flagg?
Yep.
Any idea where I could find her this morning?
You're a newspaper man from New York.
How'd you guess that, sister?
You was described to me. Will Bull can shoot his mouth off to you all he wants, but not me, nor anybody else in this town. This drugstore's run by the Paragon Watch Company, and they don't want any scandalmonger New Yorkers snooping around.
Okay, sister. And how much do I owe you?
Well, you've taken up my time.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry that I've taken up so much of your time.
So, as you watch these films every now and again, people like her will pop up and you go, hey, that's her, which is kind of fun. There's a great moment with Hazel Flagg's doctor, Dr. Enoch Downer. Yes, Dr. Downer. As he talks to people, he's talking to Wally, and he's all frustrated because apparently 20 years ago he sent in some essay to the paper to win a prize, and they didn't even, all they gave him was $1. He didn't win the prize.
He was supposed to win, what was it, like $5,000, $10,000?
I think it was a $10,000 prize, a $5,000 prize. He didn't get it. All he got was like a check for $1 and a, thanks for participating. He was all upset. But as he's talking, he just keeps leaning in further and further and further, to the point where Wally actually has to put his hand out and stop the guy and push him back. He does it 2 or 3 times. I just thought it was so much fun.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah.
I was so caught up in the story of him not getting this prize. That is hilarious.
Yeah, he does
it
actually.
But again, everybody knows somebody that stands a little bit too close, so it's not over-the-top comedy. It's just that.
Yeah, he ends up doing it a few times in the film. It's just funny. He just gets into it, and he starts just leaning in, and people just have to actually put their arm out to stop him from literally falling on them.
So I think this is one of those movies that the more you see, like, I always come back to The Lady Eve. Every time I watch that movie, I notice something else that I didn't notice before. And that's, I think, one of the best things about classic films is that there's a lot of subtlety in it. It's not like now, if they want you to notice something now in a film, they're going to make it as big and as bold as they can, and they'll probably zoom in on it, you know, whereas back then there's so much buried in the film. And I almost wonder, because, you know, back then you only had a couple of movies coming out a week, so if you wanted somebody to come to the movie theater to see a movie, it's not as if they could go and every night of the week could see a completely different movie, so I'm almost where if they didn't have that level of depth so that, to kind of draw the crowd back in so they'd come back again to see what they missed the first time.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the rest of the cast. We've mentioned Dr. Downer was Charles Winninger, who was, another little character actor that acted all throughout the 30s. Walter Connolly as Oliver Stone, the editor of the Morning Star. Those two were played a little bit over the top, as characters in some of these films and the comedies are, but not extreme, not to the point where you just kind of rolled your eyes at them. Not much, anyway. Frederick March was Wally Cook. He was really kind of the straight man through the film.
Yeah.
I thought. Everyone else played it a little bit on that next step, and he kind of was on that even one on the bottom there somewhere.
Yeah, a little bit dramatic, but so now I'm curious, have you seen him in anything else?
I have not, no. And he acted all the way up into the 70s, until a few years before his death.
And I feel like I must have seen something with him at some point. But like everything that they list, he was in the 1931 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which I have not seen. And I'm kind of like, how did I not see that?
Well, you know, actually, when you mentioned that, then I probably have, I'm almost sure I've seen that, but I wouldn't have, you know, been able to pick him out on, you know.
Yeah, you just don't, Well, so, I mean, he's been in things too where, I mean, you recognize the name of the movie and you've probably even seen it, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, that kind of thing. But right. He wasn't a main character. He wasn't the main character in it.
He even did a Death of a Salesman in the 50s as
you're,
Willie Loman.
You're looking at the same page I'm looking at. All right.
Yep.
But it's interesting that I've never seen him, or at least not that I can think of in anything. But but here's one thing to notice about him too. He doesn't have that classic leading man jaw. He doesn't have the looks.
That's what I was just gonna say, is that he doesn't have that standout, oh, that's that guy kind of appearance to him. He's just very much an everyman. He's not the Cary Grant or anything like that you would expect in a leading man of the time.
Right. Especially, I mean, in the 30s, you kind of, you're looking for that William Powell type. They, you know, that the strong, sensitive guy, but he's always going to be exceptionally good looking.
Right.
So
he's very average. He's not an ugly man. I wouldn't say he's an ugly man, but no, you're right. He's not like the. I don't imagine women swooning over him.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that one. Well, Carol Lombard is an interesting one too. I mentioned My Man Godfrey, which is. And of course, just now William Powell. Obviously, the two of them are in that together, and I love that film. But I can't think of a whole lot of other stuff that I've seen. You know, I mean, obviously, I've looked at her resume, but I can't think of a whole lot of other stuff that I've seen with her in it.
Yeah, I cannot say. I think this is probably the first thing I've seen her in.
You haven't seen My Man Godfrey?
I have actually not seen My Man Godfrey.
Oh, I actually thought well, you must know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I knew the film. You know, and I knew the film and I know the names, but I've not seen it.
Yeah. Well, she was in the original Mr. and Mrs. Smith, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. So now I have another thing. If nothing else, you're going to hear a whole bunch of stuff on this, you know, on this show program that, you know, put it on your list of things to watch.
That's going on mine.
That's one of them. Yeah. And I know I've seen the original Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I don't remember it being Carol Lombard, but I probably didn't know who she was when I was watching it.
Now, I will say, in contrast to Frederick March's plainness, Carol Lombard, that's the one thing I found in this film. She supposedly, everyone thinks she's dying of radium poisoning. One look at this woman, and there is no way anyone would believe that she's dying of anything.
Yeah, she definitely is the flower of youth and health.
Yes, and beautiful.
I suppose so. I know women are allowed to compliment other women on their looks. I don't know. I always think of like Ginger Rogers. Oh no, now I've got a Carol Lombard versus Ginger Rogers thing going. You get a name for it. But they do. I mean, they have a lot of a similar appearance.
Yeah, I thought she was very beautiful. And I just thought she was always glowing and blonde and, like you said, youthful and energetic. And like, I don't really see how anyone could buy that she's actually dying, but. We'll go with it. You know, for the sake of the plot, we'll go with it.
Well, you know, and she's got a respectable doctor backing her up on that one, even though Dr. Downer isn't necessarily all that respectable, considering I think he's drunk through about 95% of the movie.
Yes, he accompanies her to New York and indulges quite a lot.
Yeah. So the whole... and then finally, of course, she collapses when they're giving her that whole... Oh, that whole, that's kind of to me where it picks up is when they kind of start getting into the, okay, now how's she going to get out of this? When she starts regretting the decision and decides, of course, obviously, that she's falling for Wally.
Right.
You know, and that was the one I told you, one quote out of this movie that made me laugh so hard. And the whole thing where, you know, again, with the physical humor, Dr. Downer comes and he says, you know, oh, you've got a hangover here. I brought you some eggs. And he starts just pulling eggs out of every pocket in his outfit. I think he pulls out more than a dozen eggs.
Yeah.
And just like, but it's like one egg for each pocket. He doesn't have them just crammed in there. And at some point, you know, she's kind of throwing a tantrum, kind of like, this is terrible. Everything's horrible. And he says, suck this egg, I tell you. And he's like trying to get her to suck the yolks out of the eggs. It totally made me laugh.
I brought you something. Raw eggs. Just what you need. The albumin counteracts the alcohol. Suck them right down. Settle your stomach. Go on. I got a whole dozen.
Is this the way drunks feel?
Hazel, you've got what is known in medicine as a hangover.
Got something worse than that. I've got a conscience. Oh.
Keep on sucking that egg and your conscience will go away.
I've never heard of that as a cure for a hangover, but definitely suck this egg, I tell you. Now, that's going to be, anytime anybody complains in the future, I'm going to say, suck this egg.
You're going to carry around eggs in your purse.
That, honestly, I might start doing that.
just
so I can tell just, people to suck the egg.
Just in case the opportunity arises. Suck this egg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's so much of the... of this movie that has, you know, it's quick-witted and it's got a lot of physical humor to it. I'm going to keep saying that over and over till you agree with me.
Oh, I do agree. I agree. I've already agreed on that. Well, let's talk about some of the wit that is in this film. And there is plenty. And, you know, I thought it was funny. There's a little bit of social commentary that is actually more relevant today than even in the 30s. There's a lot of kind of what a newspaper would go through to get a story kind of thing. And I'm thinking, you know, with the recent phone hacking scandals and things like that that have gone on in the UK and abroad, and you know, it's like kind of seeing it here.
Mm-hmm.
I also really appreciate there's a couple really great scenes that just pretty much said that no matter how important the news story is. There's a beautiful scene where they're doing the usual, you know, the newspaper headlines are coming up at the screen and, you know, Hazel Flagg, brave, you know, facing death, all this stuff and everything. And the next, there's one and the newspaper's filling a screen and the next shot, a giant fish lands right in the middle of the paper.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
It gets folded up as, you know, down at the dock. And I'm like, that's pretty much it. No matter how important, no matter how big the story is on next Tuesday, come Wednesday, it's somebody's fish wrapper.
Yeah, exactly.
There was a couple of, I mean, that was just one of those really great, where I thought it was almost ahead of its time, shots. Was that
with the fish landing
was
in
the fish in the paper? Because it was just doing this, you know, the headline coming up, and then the next headline, and then fish. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Usually they'd fade to another scene at that point. That. Mm-hmm. Thinking about just some different things, the whole part about her collapsing in front of everybody. Of course, she's not sick, she's drunk. And so she collapses, but at that point, just them going through the list of all these great women, you know, they who all do they list?
Well, see, there's Pocahontas.
Yeah. There's Lady
Godiva. Which is a Lady Godiva, but I enjoyed Pocahontas, who was a catcalled from the audience by a man and Native American with the feather in the headband.
And right before that, the Lady Godiva comes out, and you get the older guy that, you know, whistles or whatever, and she like winks at him, and then Pocahontas comes out, and there's a Native American guy. You know,
I think Joan of Arc maybe was one of them. They had about
four women riding out on stage. The Dutch girl who I'd never heard of before.
Yeah, the Dutch girl who had put her finger in the dike.
And he says, show him the finger, babe. she flips off the entire audience. So social gestures may not be as innovative as we think they are.
No. Yes, but just fantastic, over the top, incredible stage production at this dance club, because they all ride out on horses, ride out on stage.
Right onto the stage.
And now adding to these great women of history, Hazel Flagg, and they get her to come down and on the stage, and she's
And what you were saying about the social commentary is so interesting, because, I mean, he does, he goes to this big effort to bring this girl down who's dying to show her a great time, you know, right before she dies. And, you know, and everybody makes such a big deal out of her, but then the reality is they're so depressed by having her around.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're sitting there at dinner and she starts looking around. She's like, I just wish people would leave me alone. And they're looking around. And every time somebody looks at her, they kind of start crying a little bit.
They start crying or they do that, the sad, oh.
Yeah. But, you know, it's that obsession with, you know, Schadenfreude. It's people want to be around other people that have it worse than they do just so they can feel better about their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight there is one among us who adds a bit of unaccustomed drama to our little revel. She sits here, eyes sparkling, her face wreathed in a lovely smile, drinking in the charm, the glitter, the gay sounds of life. So drink your wine, laugh, and applaud while this little doomed child sits saying goodbye to you. Her last goodbye with a grateful smile on her lips. So on with the show, my little actors all. On with the show, for tonight you are not the famous folk of Broadway. Tonight you are just a little chorus laughing and dancing and pirouetting to afford a last brief hour of mirth and jollity to America's simplest and sweetest of heroines, Miss Hazel Flagg.
This film had, when I was talking about the paper and the fish, not to keep banging it, but
that's all right. I keep coming back to Ginger Rogers. Let's talk about the fish. At least the fish is in the movie.
But there was so much in the cinematography in this film that reminded me of like some of the stuff that like Mel Brooks would have done or will do, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later. There's an odd scene when Wally and Hazel are walking. They're back early in the film. They're walking through Warsaw, Vermont there. And they're walking along the street, and they stop to talk. And when they stop, there's a giant tree branch in front of them.
Yeah.
And so here's
just,
your two...
their heads.
Yes, your two main actors, and you can't see them from the shoulder up.
So it's kind of... I mean, it's interesting, because you can tell that they kind of did that, so you kind of can't tell who's telling the truth and who's not, I think. That was the impression I got. Because, you know, she's not being very forthcoming, and we already know that she's not dying because she was just told that, which of course makes her cry, which of course makes him feel sorry for her because he doesn't hear that she's not dying,
right?
You know, and so you have this whole thing where she knows that she's not dying and he doesn't know, and he's already been accused of setting up the stuff that he, you know, to get publicity, and he swears that he didn't know about the last fiasco,
right?
You know, and now you're kind of trying to figure out, okay, so we can't actually see their faces, so we don't really know. Does he know what's going on or not?
Hmm. That's interesting. I don't know. It was just, it struck me as just being really weird.
I feel like there are very few directors that, I feel like there are very few directors that do that kind of thing unintentionally. If anything, they yeah. err on the side of showing too much. You know, you very rarely have a really intentional omission of information, especially in film. Or especially in the visual portion of film. So I felt like there's got to be a purpose for them doing this. And I kind of felt like it was so that you kind of don't know really, you know, who's in on the gig, on the jig, the jig, on the gig.
On the jig, on the gig, on whichever.
The jig, I think, is what I was trying to say.
Yes.
But, I mean, great. That's, I didn't get too into the technical side of this film. I didn't think about it too hard because, you know, unless you're watching a film, especially a classic film, and they're telling you, oh, you should watch for this or watch for that, you generally don't think about it. But that one, that particular shot with the branch right in their faces, you really kind of like, I actually felt kind of like they should be kissing on the other side of that, because isn't that
yes.
usually what they do? They pan away.
Right.
You're kind of like, oh, right.
Oh, don't shield your eyes. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah, definitely interesting.
Well, there's another scene later on down in the film. They are on the riverside. Hazel decides she's going to fake her suicide so she can get out of all of this and everyone can save face. And you know, Wally, of course, quote-unquote, saves her by actually pushing her into the river. But they get back to the shore, and he's like, "All right, I got to talk to you. Here's as good a place as any." And he throws
her
into
a crate.
And so the camera pans, the conversation starts, and they're talking, and you can't see them. You're looking at a wood wall.
And it just really slowly pans around, and I kind of expected him to, like, you know, at the end of my all-time favorite classic film, The Lady Eve, you know, they close the door really slowly so you can't see what's going on, but you can hear them finishing their conversation. I kept expecting the same kind of thing to be going on. I kept expecting them to say, "Oh, I love you, honey," and then to kind of fade out and then go on to the next scene, but it doesn't. Weirdly, it goes all the way around to the side of the crate, so you can kind of see them talking through these bars again.
Yeah, it gives you a very kind of almost a voyeuristic quality to the scene, because you kind of like, "Well, wait, I can't see him. Let's just move over here. Ah, there I go. Right, I can kind of see him through the crack there." Yeah.
There's a little bit of a shadow. Yeah, definitely. So you almost wonder. I mean, in that case, I could see the argument for, well, maybe they're just experimenting a little bit with film and seeing what kind of works and what kind of doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something to point out about this film. This has been in a couple different places. This film was in Technicolor, 1937, to let you know. Color films back in the days weren't as common as, certainly not as, you know, like they are now. But this was apparently, and I've seen this reported this way in several sites, so forgive me, I'm quoting, the first quote-unquote screwball comedy filmed in Technicolor.
Really?
And it's actually, apparently, it was Carol Lombard's only color film.
Really?
Yes, because nothing prior to this was in color, and then nothing, she only did four or five films after this.
That's right.
She died about 5 years later.
Yep, 1942, I saw.
Mm-hmm, in a tragic plane crash, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So this was her only color film, and so this was the first screwball comedy in color. So that could be it. Maybe they were like, "Okay, we're in color, so let's, you know, what can we do? You know, how can we make it look?" I would love to see this thing restored. Supposedly, Disney, of all people, did a full restoration from the original print.
On this?
On this film. But they've yet to release it. It's not out on DVD or Blu-ray or anything.
Disney. Yeah. Oh, I probably should keep my prejudices silent while we're on the air.
That's what I've read anyway. And it's like, you know, the copy you can find online on Archive is not a bad copy. It's actually one of the better quality films that I've seen off of there. But even still, I would love to see this fully restored in the bright, bold Technicolor colors of the time.
Yeah, because it does. It has a little bit of that washed out feel to it. But I just assumed that that was just. I didn't think there was a better version available, so it didn't really bother me.
Yeah. Apparently, there's not. Not one available,
yeah, well,
anyway.
Not they're, available, but...
Yeah, one may exist, but it's not available.
Right.
But apparently did a lot of other firsts with this. They did a lot of special new process effects with the color, a lot of the montages and some rear screen projections. So technically, this film kind of laid a lot of groundwork for films to come.
Yeah.
So it was an important film in film history, which surprises me that it's just been sort of left to rot on the ages kind of thing.
Well, now I feel like I need to watch it again. I feel like I need to like research it thoroughly before I watch it this time.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, you know what was fun that I enjoyed about this film is I actually really, I mean, I literally laughed out loud at this film while watching it.
Yeah, there were definitely a couple of scenes. Well, a lot of it, like, you kind of see it coming, but the whole thing where he's trying to get her to, at the point where she's supposed to have pneumonia, and he's trying to, you know, he's really trying hard to get one by his boss and make it look like she really does have pneumonia. And he's like, you have to be in a cold sweat and you have to be breathing really hard. And so he starts trying to get her to fight with him.
Yeah.
It's really funny. Again, it comes back to that physical humor that I think she became really well known for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it feels like we don't get a whole lot of that anymore. You either get the kind of ridiculous over the top slapstick, or you get, you know, just a serious drama.
Yeah.
But no, they definitely, I mean, the technical aspects aside, well, the technical aspects included, it's an entertaining film, if nothing else.
Very
and
much.
And I think we're talking about, it's not a very long film.
No, it is, to talk about an easy watch, I think it only clocks in at a little over 70 minutes. So it's not even an hour and a half,
yeah.
Barely over an hour. And so it makes it for an easy watch. And like I said, I laughed out loud. I mean, this is a film that is like, you know, I'll go back and watch this again just because.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, and to be fair, all of these that we've been watching so far, you know, obviously one of them I recommended because I'd already seen it, but I don't think anything that we've watched yet I wouldn't go back and watch again if only for nostalgia's sake. But none of them are just so awful. You know, this one happens to be one of the... This is really genuinely a funny film.
Yeah, very much. And I'm actually kind of glad that we didn't go through this plot all the way through and spoil everything. Because really, of all the films we've seen, this is the one that I'm like, you know what, people? You really need to go and watch this. It is not...
You really do.
First of all, it's in color. So I know there's a lot of people that when it comes to older films, they're really turned off by the black and white. So you don't have that excuse for this one.
Tisk, tisk.
And yeah, exactly. It is a smart film, and it's not a stupid film. Yes, maybe it's a little dated. Obviously, like you were talking, you know, the fight scene, you know, trying to get her to work up, and the fight scene.
Yeah, the fight scene.
And the fight scene. There was actually even a wrestling scene in there in the film. They take her to the fights.
The pro wrestling. I love that scene. What I loved about that scene, you know, they've got that moment of fight. They ring the bell they're not WWF anymore because that's the World Wildlife Fund or whatever, but they're whatever they call them now, you know. And they're up there and they're on the ropes and the one's climbing on the other one and the ref is like climbing up on, and they ding the bell and they all just kind of climb off each other and they go through and they have this moment of silence because Hazel's in the audience and, you know, it's this really touching moment. They ding the bell again and the three of them climb right back up into the scene they were in and go back. It's so funny. And I mean, for us to go through, you know, minute by minute and say, and then this happens and then this happens, it would sound like we're, you know, refereeing a football game or something like that. There's so much of this film that's not expressed through the dialogue. There's so much of it that's physical, the physical humor.
And there's so much that we could describe, but it wouldn't be near as funny.
Yes.
As actually
even
watching
laughing at it. Yeah.
Wouldn't be able to do it justice. No, so this was just, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to say about it.
I think only that knowing now that Carol Lombard has been in some things with James Stewart, who is one of my mom's all-time favorite actors, whom I've come to really appreciate. Seeing kind of the long list of things that that Frederick March was in, knowing that the guy who played Oliver Stone, I'm not going to remember his name, but what's kind of fun about doing this kind of thing, about seeing these films that are so old, from, you know, 1937, but that have a lot of people that were really well known at that time, is you get to discover new actors. So I mean, this is really, it's prompting me to want to go back and find more Carol Lombard stuff, because, you know, she is very funny, to find more stuff by Frederick March, because I'm really curious. He was in a lot of stuff. I mean, he obviously continued to act long after she had passed away, but I can't place him in anything I've seen. So it makes me really want to go back and see them in other films and then come back and watch this again and have them in some kind of a context.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, this has been so much fun watching some of these older films for that very reason. Yeah, I'm starting to see names and recognize, I'm putting faces to names that I've heard of. I mean, I've always been a fan of films, but my knowledge base is very small, unfortunately.
Limited.
Limited, thank you. Yeah, very limited. And so it's really fun to actually, okay, I've heard the name Carol Lombard. And so it was really fun to actually see a film with her in it and kind of go, oh, now I see why I've heard that name. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it does make me want to go back and watch some of her other films. Mm-hmm. And like you were just saying with Frederick March, just because he's been in so much, it's like, well, you know, what types of characters has he done? Has he always done the straight drama, or did he do anything that was a little bit more, you know, slapsticky, even more than this? Or was he ever the heavy? You know, I'd really like to see what his range was.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So, I mean, because we get just a very two-dimensional image of him in this as the serious newspaper man. But, I mean, he has been in several films that are, you know, we've all heard of. I mean, obviously, I don't want to go down the list again, but he has a very thorough, can't think of the right word. I want to say CV, but that's not the right word for it. That's the English one for it. I'm not English. Keep reminding me that. Resume. That's the word I wanted. That's what I used before. He's got these, you know, this resume that's got all of these movies that we've got remakes of. I mean, we've got remakes of Alexander the Great, you know, and oh gosh, I just saw another one. Well, you know, I mentioned The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, which I always equate to The Horse in the Gray Flannel Suit. Slightly different storyline.
A little
in that
different,
one.
Maybe.
But you know, he's been in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and all those things that we've seen remakes of, and we forget that they came from, you know, an original film somewhere, and most of them were actually, it seems like, adapted from the film version rather than the book version. So, you know, he was in Death of a Salesman. I can honestly say I've never seen Death of a Salesman, any version of it, but he was in one
really?
Of the first ones. Yeah.
Hmm.
Played Willie Loman, the main guy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it is, and I wonder, I know I have seen two or three versions of Death of a Salesman, and I'm wondering which one I saw and whether it was the one he was in.
Yeah. And you'll go back and watch it and say, I have seen this before. He was in
this. Or I'll say, no, I haven't, because there's probably a dozen versions of Death of a Salesman.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of remakes, he was in the 1935 version of Les Mis.
Oh, well, there you go, which is going to be coming out in theaters here soon-ish.
Yeah, we're going to just slide that.
Mm-hmm.
They should pay us. The studio should pay us. But it's interesting. I mean, he's been in so many things, I think. I must have seen him in something, you know, and I keep wanting to scroll down through. But, you know, if nothing else, then there are a lot of classic stories that he's been in that it would be really neat to watch and see his take on those characters.
Yep. And I'm actually very curious to see, to try to find some more films that were directed by this William Wellman.
Oh, the director, sorry.
Yeah, the director. And see if there's...
Directed by the director.
Directed by the director, which is a good thing for a director to do. I'm glad he found, you know, his place in life as a director.
Right, yeah.
Directing
it
films.
It makes sense to be a director that directs, yeah.
Yes. But after watching this, now, and getting sort of a taste of, you know, with the tree branch, the crate, those types of shots, and how he directed this film.
Bojest. I didn't even look him up, but he directed Bojest, which is one of the greatest films Gary Cooper was ever in. Oh, great movie. Yeah, there you go. Hey, your mic is cutting out just a little bit.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bit or a little bit?
Every few syllables we miss, or every few words we miss a syllable.
Okay, well, yours has kind of been doing the same off and on, too, so.
Okay. So maybe it's actually my connection.
No, it's probably just Skype being Skype.
Or me nodding my head. Anyway, sorry, back to, he directed, Bojest, yeah, great movie.
So, yeah, I'd really like to go back and watch some of his films and just see if I can see it. if he's one of those directors that just has that particular style, or if it's one of those directors that just, it changes with every film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be very interesting. Because like we were talking about, it feels like there's some experimentation taking place in this one. So it'd be interesting to know if this is one of his earliest films, you know, if he really was experimenting and kind of where he went from there. No, not one of his earliest films. He did a bunch before this. But it would be interesting to see if he kept the fish.
Yes. Exactly. No, but if you haven't already figured out by how we've been talking about it, definitely a film we'd recommend, I think.
Yeah.
For just anybody. I mean, this is a film that I think anyone can go watch. This could be
anybody over the age of 10, you know, to really get what's going on. But even, yeah, I would probably say anybody over the age of 10.
There is really nothing overly offensive in this film at all.
No, that's definitely not a...
You can watch it in front of your kids.
No, yeah. But as far as, like, appreciating the humor and getting
sure.
kind of underplayed sense of humor.
Yep, exactly. And you might have to explain that, you know, no, it's not okay to hit a girl.
Yeah, no. That's one of the things that I saw that made me laugh. And what is it he says? He comes out and he's like, you let me, you stood there and let me hit a defenseless woman. And he says, yes, I did. He's like, what's wrong with you or something like that? And he's like, well, you know, you did it. You're the one that was doing it. He says, that's different. I love her. And
yeah, that makes it all okay.
Your kid's not okay to hit a woman. But she gets him back.
Yes, she does. Again, with a few more really cute little touches of the physical comedy.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, I think that's about all we can really say about this one. I apologize. This one felt a little bit more scattershot than we've done in the past.
Honestly, though, I mean, considering the film itself, it really, there's so much of it that's physical humor that to go through it just play by play would be, I think, incredibly painfully boring. But to watch it, it's really entertaining.
Yes, very much. This actually may be a film, you know, I've been kind of knocking around in my head the idea of doing a like commentary with the film. Sort of MST style without all the making fun of it part.
I don't know. That might be stretching it for me. But there are some films. There are films you walk into and you sit down and you start making fun of it with the first line. Great example of that is The Matrix 3. That was just horrible. It was awful. Literally the first words out of Trinity's mouth, and I was mocking it. It was awful. This isn't that kind of movie. It's definitely. It's really humorous. It's really enjoyable. And the last thing I have to say on it is, suck this egg. That's the important thing to take home, ladies and gentlemen. Take the egg home. And the fish.
Yes. And a fish. Well, all right then. Well, Lydia, thank you very much for joining me for this one.
Thank you, Chris.
And we will be back in a month to cover another fun film that we dig out of the archives.
Or maybe a really horrible one. I keep crossing my fingers for a really, really bad movie.
Okay, well, if you really want to bet, I've had my sights on one or two. I think I could find something.
Now let's stay away from the film noir with the bizarre stuff going on over there. But definitely, if you can find a really bad film, I would hopefully keep your fingers crossed. That'll be next month.
Alrighty. Well, there you go. We'll start the year out right.
Hopefully.
All right. Well, thanks for listening thanks for listening, everybody, and I hope you join us again, bad film or not, come January. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.